Hello and welcome to The Dominant Paradigm, an American Gods podcast. Episode 3, Head Full of Snow. We're your hosts,
Dwayne D.
Andrew Cersini, and this week, again, we have Tosin Anofowakin with us as our special continued guest. We just watched the third episode of Starz American Gods titled Head Full of Snow. We assume you have as well. So total spoilers ahead. Let's dive into the aftertalk. But before we do, let's catch you up on how to reach us. Here are some of our online links. You can follow us on Twitter at Gods Podcast or just hashtag The Dominant Paradigm. Our Facebook page is Podcast American Gods. And you can write or send us a voice memo at starsamericangodspod@gmail.com. And you can always check us out on Geeks of Doom. You can add us on iTunes. And if you do so, please like us and leave a review. All right. So let's talk about episode 3, Head Full of Snow. Dwayne, why don't you give us a little brief little recap of what we saw tonight?
Got it. All right, so we're greeted with the cityscape of New York. We're in Queens. We see an older woman standing on a rickety footstool to gain access to a jar of pickled fruit for a family gathering that evening. A knock on the door reveals that Mr. Jackal, played by Chris Obi, has arrived. He tells her that she's actually died. And, you know, she's surprised, as we've seen in other narratives. She goes with him, and they effectively travel up to the dunes of Egypt, where he gives her access to five doors, and her cat pushes her into one. We return down to Chicago, where Shadow is. He wakes up at night. He finds his way onto a rooftop, and he goes to an open window where he meets Zoria Polochnaya, the sister that was sleeping earlier in episode 2. Mm-hmm. And she explains what their purpose is, that each sister has a shift watching the sky to make sure a demon doesn't destroy the entire planet. She sort of reads Shadow, whether it's his fortune or some his aura or whatever, and he admits that the world isn't what he thought it was. She promises to help him if he kisses her. She steals a kiss from him, and she gives him a coin that he's not to give away, some sort of protection. Shadow wakes up, visits Chernobog, and they have one more checkers game, wherein Shadow basically says, if I win, you'll come with us before you have to kill me. And at the same time, Wednesday is flirting with the elder sister, Zoria Vectronaya, and he kind of takes her out, and they do a walk, and, you know, the rain falls, and all these interesting romantic things happen. And then Wednesday and Shadow rob a bank. Mad Sweeney reappears and is haunted with bad luck. Turns out the coin he gave Shadow seems to have some magic. And we meet the djinn, who's an ifrit, who changes places with an Omani salesman. And when Shadow gets back to his hotel room at the end of the day, Laura's sitting on his bed, and we're not sure if it's a dream or something else. Yeah. So that's the recap. Salient points, guys. What are you thinking? Stuck out to you?
What's interesting about this is that I think we've established in the first couple of episodes that we get a sort of coming to an America tale, and that's sort of a carryover from the book as well. In this episode, we actually get two coming to America tales, which is interesting. We have the opening story with the elderly woman who is making the soup for her family. She goes, you know, she reaches up to get a jar of pickled something or other, and I love the fact that in this opening scene here, they do some very sort of traditional suspense moments where you see her reaching up to get the jar, her foot on the rickety step stool, the step stool sort of creaking back and forth, and then you're thrown for a loop because you get the unexpected, you know, it gets turned on its ear when she steps down and nothing happens at all, and then of course, like within a minute, that whole thing gets upended as well, because you realize it did happen. It just, we didn't, you know, she wasn't aware of it until essentially the agent of death comes knocking on her door.
There's this great moment where it looks like what you're saying, it's rickety. She's like bouncing her socks, mm-hmm. or her sandals, whatever. And you almost hear her imperceptibly cry out, but then she steps down and you're like, okay, what happened there?
Right.
And that was really interesting to me because that cry was possibly, you know, her actually dying but not knowing it. What's also interesting is that these two scenes were called Somewhere in America and not Coming to America, as if there's a bifurcation between
right.
people living their lives versus when gods emigrate over here. So that was also interesting. Either way, the vignettes are key, apparently, to the greater story.
Right. Also, what's interesting about this is that the woman makes note of the fact that she is Muslim, and that this particular visage of death that visits her is not a Muslim part of the Muslim religion, but it's something that she was taught as a kid. So she's brought it over from the old country into America. She brought this person.
She's tied in with this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So here's my question. If she falls,
yeah,
how does that jar get by the sink where she can taste it?
That's a lot of questions.
And right, how does that happen? How does she open it? They're going to come in and find the jar broken and smashed? Or they're going to come in and find the jar? I don't know.
Who knows if it ever
It was even... all the cat. It was always the cat.
Which is a very sort of Egyptian cat, too, right? The whole, like...
Right. The Sphinx. They call that a Sphinx.
Like, who knows if that jar of pickled whatever it was actually made it into the soup. If you know, she gives him a taste,
Anubis, yeah,
of it, but who knows if that was actually a taste or if it is just a sort of figurative taste of it.
Right, it's super like abstract, because she also takes off her apron and puts it down before she leaves. It's like these habits, and that's kind of great. Oh. I love the scene. I really liked it. I just was, my head was kind of spinning with those kinds of questions.
That's another thing.
I also loved...
I was going to say, that's another thing that I wanted to bring up about this section with Mrs. Fadil and Anubis, is that from the moment that she dies, then the scene moves into this dreamlike state from the literal to the figurative. Like when she and Anubis are walking up to the roof, then the apartment complex becomes impossibly high. The staircase becomes impossibly endless up to the sky. It then reaches a point of figurative, and then she even points it out by saying, "You know, this is not Queens anymore."
Right. Yeah, exactly.
It's actually pretty interesting because that's the second time that we've seen in the same episode. Second time we've seen someone go outside of a window, going up to a place that just a place that maybe doesn't exist or maybe does. It's pretty unique.
Yeah, I mean that was definitely really interesting. The fact that she's gone up and it transforms. It's like they found a way to take her from Queens to the sands of ancient Egypt where the five doors exist. And the idea that the cat was following them was also interesting because cats are traditionally, whether it's Egyptian folklore or older Western stuff, cats have traditionally been this thing where they see ghosts. They can commune with the dead. They'll hiss at things that are paranormal. You know, in the paranormal community, having a cat is like kind of having a canary in the coal mine. So that was interesting that they use the cat in that way. And I thought that was pretty well done. Also, just like that transition to the afterlife, and then that the whole admission, like, I don't want to see my father who used to beat me.
Right, you know? Right.
That was also pretty interesting because you don't have a lot with this actress and with this character, but you learn a lot about the character, and that's pretty powerful. That's very good storytelling. So I was pleased with that. And then you know just how they transformed it without having like a fade to the sands or anything. Like we're gonna show you how she gets there.
Right.
All of that was really cool. But Tosin, rooftops, right? You were just talking about windows and rooftops.
Yeah, no, I mentioned later on in the episode, we see, you know, Shadow also having his own revelation on the rooftop, similar to Ms. Fadil here. Now, you know, it's, I think we kind of sort of discussed the revelation in terms of, like, Egyptian culture, but when you're going up to the rooftops, you know, there's sort of the heavenly, the stars, the you know, out of this world nature that you know we may be visiting here. That's an elevation of sorts.
Oh, good layout. I like that.
Right.
So yeah, she definitely got elevated. And then, you know, in both cases, they were kind of enlightened, shadows enlightened when he meets Zoya Polishnaya. And he has to elevate himself to get there. And then the same thing happens with Mrs. Fadil. So that was crazy. Speaking of Mrs. Fadil, she's back to her old and cranky self at the end of the scene. She's like, are you sure? You know, I'm not going to see my grandma again if you're the wrong god for me or whatever. And that was interesting because she gets really kind of quiet, reticent, and she's taken aback by the whole situation. She's worried about her heart not doing, not balancing the feather. She says all these things about how, like, oh, she was wrong to the first boy who loved her, all this stuff. These are trivial admissions, right? Like, yeah, people, you know, like, she hasn't killed anyone. She hasn't done, like, any kind of nefarious stuff. But for her, those things are terrible. And that kind of gives you an idea about her. But I thought it was great how, after that was all said and done, the business is done. She knows she's okay. Mm-hmm. She's like, are you sure you're all right?
Yeah,
she goes from saying you're a nice man to like, boy, do you know what you're talking about? So I thought that was
right. And then
really interesting.
The cat sort of like finishes the job.
Yeah, that was hilarious, right?
Like, get in,
get out of here already.
But it's interesting. She's given this choice between these five doors and which one to go in through. You know, it's like you reach the afterlife, and then you have to choose what afterlife world you live in. In your afterlife, which is
Westworld or Samurai World?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, really. It's a callback to our other podcast. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly.
Seriously.
But this is not the first time we see dunes in this episode. I mean, we don't see dunes just once, right?
Yeah, well, both of the sort of somewhere in America tales that we get in this story involve gods that are African, whether it be, you know, Northern African or basically just mainly Northern African. Yeah.
Oman's in the Middle East. It's next to it. It's like right there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we are talking about the same general area, which is primarily a dune, a desert area. So it's interesting to have those two lumped together. Stunning visuals. And vastly different than the America that we're used to seeing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was pretty powerful. Also, I feel like in the book, the salesman also mentions that his grandmother had told him stories about the jinn and the ifrit.
Right.
So this idea that your grandmothers are passing this knowledge through you.
Right.
They can exist. That's also pretty cool. But yeah, so those visuals are great. Last week we had a lot of blood. This week, the week before, it was like a lot of lynching stuff. And here, it's all about precipitation, which is super kind of abstract compared to the other things. But then if you think about it, blood and then water, you know, there's something to that medium that's moving. Andy.
Yeah, we had rain in the beginning of the episode when Wednesday is walking the elder Zoria. Down the street, we have snow. You know, later on in the episode, when they pull off the heist, the robbing the bank, and throughout, there's this sort of this overall like storm. I get the constant sense that a storm is coming. I think that's the sort of the metaphor that we're meant to be left with, is that there is an approaching storm, and it's oncoming. It's something that you know, we haven't seen the light at the end of the storm yet.
Yeah, it's kind of all Wednesday's fault too.
Yeah, well, I mean, the question is whether or not it's a figurative storm or whether or not it's a metaphor or it's actually happening in reality, right? I think that's one of there's a actually lengthy conversation that Wednesday has with Shadow in this episode, kind of discussing, you know, what they believe is true and like how it, and you know, what it says about himself as an individual. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, I think part of that really brings out the human elements of Shadow, something that we don't necessarily get a grasp of the book. We touched upon this a little bit last week, but you know, one of the things that we notice, you know, in some of the in the especially the Clouds one is this was happened right before the rainstorm, I believe, you know, one of the interesting visuals is you know, in the night sky where we had Polichinelle's, she's looking at the demon bear who she's always supposed to keep an eye out for, and he's starting to obscure that, which is not a good sign.
Yeah, I mean, your job is to stare at the sky, and then suddenly, I mean,
you had one job.
You have one job, and then that's getting blocked. So, it's interesting because whatever Wednesday's doing, people are not necessarily happy about, right? Everyone's begrudgingly going toward it. Mad Sweeney, you know, Chernabog, whatever, and it's like Wednesday's causing trouble, and here he's also causing trouble for her by putting a storm in front of her eyes so she can't see what she's supposed to do. Speaking of the sky, anyone else notice that when she took down the moon and turned it into a coin, the stars like flickered out, like just like the signs in like the American God sign or the Motel America sign, you know, kind of like neons.
And the lights in the buildings came on as well at the same time.
Yeah, it was weird because the stars flicker out, but if you're ever hiking on a moonlit night, full moon or something, you'll know that you can't see the stars because of the moon. So what she did was actually the opposite of what happens in reality, which is a good metaphor for the fact that A, he's kind of dreaming this thing, if he's dreaming it at all, and B, this world isn't behaving. He says the world isn't behaving the way he thinks it does, because you know, visually, when you have no moon, you have many stars. But when she pulls down the moon, the stars go away. So I thought that was a pretty interesting take on, you know, visuals kind of backing up what he's saying. The world isn't working the way it doesn't work the way I think it does. So I thought that was a pretty pretty interesting. I don't know, I feel like that's it for me for salient points. What about you?
Did we talk about Zarya Vereshchaya's coat?
No, we didn't. She's got, I mean, it sounds kind of dumb, but at the same time, when you look at her coat, there's all these patterns on it.
Yeah.
And if you're at all familiar with like Northern Europe around Finland, Sweden and Russia in that area, it's like Lapland. Those patterns are like old school ethnic Slavic embroidery. And you also see it in Zarya Polichnaya's nightgown, because in the book, she's just wearing like a really simple, almost see-through nightgown. And here, she's also got that embroidery that shows off her identity, her culture. And I thought that was also pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's a nice little detail. It's a fun little detail. It's not, I don't think it's incredibly significant to the overall story, but it's a nice detail to add to the texture of the presentation.
Yeah, texture. That's exactly the word I was looking for. It was totally a texture thing. It's like you can feel them. They're not just these ethereal things.
Let's get into some of the big picture stuff, how these events that we saw in this episode affect the overarching story arc. So let's talk about Mrs. Fadil. So this is a point from the book. You know, the Anubis measures your heart against a feather to judge you. We see that in the book. Mrs. Fadil's definitely not your sweet grandmother stereotype, complaining about her grandchildren that are stupid, complaining about how, you know, when after she's dead, there'll be a great grandchild named after her. And then she says, but it's going to have a bullshit middle name. Right. And, you know, Anubis agrees. Yeah, it's going to have a bullshit middle name.
I cracked up about that one. Yeah,
It's just really funny because it's like, I mean, you think about it. It's like a great honor to name your kid after someone you really cared about. But then for that person, it's like, huh? What's going on? Like, this is like something that like that's going to be my legacy. Damn it. I also liked how she was talking about one of her musically inclined grandkids or relations. And she talks to the cat. And she's like, he sounds like you, which is. In my family, it's like a running joke that there are people who sing that sound like cats. So it was really funny for her to say that to me because I just started like giggling out loud and I couldn't stop myself. Because when you're a grandma, you know, like when you get to a certain age, Yeah. People just say whatever's on their mind. They don't have any kind of filter.
Right.
Like 68, 70 kind of thing. God bless them. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, that was really funny.
I really enjoyed when she was, well, when she just assumed he was going to come in and rob her place.
Yeah.
And yeah, was like,
I'm busy, just rob me.
Yeah, it was like, I've got this this thing, this phone, it makes calls, my like son or someone says that it can also take photos.
It's also a camera, apparently.
Yeah, it's also a camera, apparently. Yeah. Pretty good.
Exactly. We touched on this before, but Tosin, it's a Muslim home. What's up?
Yeah, so I think we talked about how she was really surprised that Anubis was the one coming for her. She originally thought he was going upstairs for the black family upstairs. Her grandmother, I think, really educated her the ways of Egypt, the old and new ways, and her youthful belief in the native Egyptian pantheon sort of seems to potentially trump her belief in Islam.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there at first it seemed like she was sort of questioning, and then once she realized that she was dead, she just sort of accepted the nature of things and accepted that her journey was over.
Yeah, that was really interesting. She's like, okay, well, it's like, when you're we're all alive, so when you're alive is not a useful thing to say. But we are taught, the various mythologies and stories of our world, right? So right now, I would say that there are a few competing paradigms, but the dominant paradigm in the West is this idea that there is a single God, and that God has, possibly a heaven, a hell, there's an afterlife based on all that stuff. And so you end up with this story, and we're all used to that story. But at the same time, the question is, because her grandmother told her these other stories, did she perhaps believe them more? Was she perhaps more interesting? But moreover, if you die and someone comes knocking and says, hey, it's time to take you to the afterlife, you're kind of going to be like, oh, well, I guess I had it wrong if it's not exactly what you thought, right?
Your gods are not necessarily tied to your heritage or your ancestors, but tied to who you believe or who you choose to bring over from the old country.
Where your faith is, right? Yeah. That's pretty cool. And, when you think about her, like, going to get judged, right? In the Christian world, St. Peter judges you at the pearly gates.
Yeah.
In this ancient, Egyptian world, you get the feather. In Islam, there are various levels of heaven. And, in Norse mythology, you've got Valhalla versus Hell. Hell is not necessarily a bad place, but it's pretty Hades kind of style. But when I look at all this stuff, she's like, I think I mentioned it before. She's like, oh, I broke the heart of the first man who loved me. And like, maybe I stole some money once or something. You think about what she has done. And that's kind of interesting. She says she did her best. And he says, your best is good. But all her complaining and vexing aside, by normal standard, just an American way of life, having 8 grandchildren, healthy enough to have grown up, even if you don't think they're smart, is the kind of achievement that most people who want a family want by the time they go. You can't have done it. You can have done it terribly. And she tells us that when she says, I don't want to see my father because he beat me. But clearly she didn't pass that on. She broke that chain. So there's kind of these super mundane wins she had during her life, which I thought were really, really interesting. And it's kind of all, and I don't know. I thought that as a regular person was a thing, but yeah, all about belief, right?
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the conversation that Wednesday and Shadow have about belief. Speaking of that, he says, Wednesday says that the U.S. is the only country that wonders what it is. The others know what they are. No one wonders about the heart of Norway or goes searching for the soul of Mozambique. Mozambique knows what it is. Americans know who they are. They pretend.
Yeah, that's what Shadow says back. He's like, Americans know who they are. And then Wednesday says.
Yeah, he says they pretend they know. They're still just pretending like I'm pretending now. And Shadow says, "What am I pretending?" And he says, "You're pretending you can't believe in impossible things." And Shadow says, "I'm genuinely deluded if I believe in that shit." And Wednesday says, "If you're deluded, I believe it's genuine. You don't strike me as the disingenuous type."
That's a little bit of the magic of Ian McShane's ability to deliver that line, right? Like, he completely changes the conversation. He doesn't want to argue about this anymore. But at the same time, he's saying, you have to believe. And if you're deluded, he's effectively explaining faith, right? If you genuinely believe, yeah, you may be deluded, but it's faith and that's fine.
Yeah. What else? Wednesday gets him to believe in the power of his own mind. He tells Shadow to think snow. And it's sort of like suggestion that becomes reality, like casting a spell, and snow does actually happen, and we're not entirely sure whether or not it happened as a cause of Shadow's willing it into being or not. Shadow certainly isn't sure, and I think maybe at the end of the day, only Wednesday believes with 100% certainty that it was Shadow that caused the snow. I know Shadow doesn't know.
What was actually what I kind of cracked up about is we know that Shadow likes marshmallows in his hot chocolate.
Yes.
But I think the visuals were actually pretty intriguing there. You had the car Betty, I believe it was called, like flying through the marshmallow snow atmosphere.
Oh, yeah. That was random.
That's a nice little Brian Fuller touch.
Yeah, right. You had when they're in getting business cards and making copies, which I'm not quite sure that was in the book, but you had the copy machine like starting to crystallize over.
It's nice
pretty interesting touches.
It's nice to see the sort of procedural aspect of pulling off a heist like that. You get to see sort of the details of how that happens. So it's nice because it gives you a fuller understanding of how this scam works, which you did get. I feel like you did see that in the book. You did sort of get to see the intricacies of that. Not up
the
to...
mundane aspect, the tactics as opposed to the strategy. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of – in the book, there's a lot of scams. They talk about a lot of scams, right? And it's really interesting to think how, I mean, Shadow's a criminal, a convicted criminal, and Wednesday is like pretty much an unconvicted criminal, and it's not as if Mad Sweeney's a law-abiding citizen. So the kind of criminal element is really cool. And I think you're right. The mundane nature of how they do this heist and the whole, like, I'm going to rob a bank doesn't mean what we think it means. It's like her standing on the stool, right? We think she's falling. She isn't falling. We didn't see her fall, but she died. It's like, I'm going to rob a bank. Shadow's like covering his face in the bank, and meanwhile Wednesday's doing his robbing, and it's not even a question of, hey, give me all your money. It's a question of people willingly giving their money to him because they have faith in the bank. They believe.
Is there anything else you wanted to say about the subject of belief?
Yeah, Wednesday had something that was pretty poignant, pretty on point. He said, the only thing that scares me is being forgotten. I can survive most things, but not that. I think it's pretty interesting to think about that as we look at all the characters that we've come across.
Yeah.
Laura, Shadow, as well as all the friends, and sort of what they left behind. And, and it's very compelling to hear that from Wednesday, who, seems to sort of say, hey, whatever you guys believe is true is what is going to sort of stick with you. And he even tells Shadow that, hey, when you think back on this day, what are you going to remember? Like, remembering that it snowed, remembering that you were able to make that happen potentially,
right,
or
right.
at least that it occurred when you were thinking about it. Well, that keeps that forever, right? This is another way of, keeping yourself sort of like the middle name, right? Or sort of like naming after someone. This is another way of always being there and always persisting.
That's true. It's about that kind of persistence. I dug that.
It goes right back to what we had talked about even in the very first episode about how one of the core themes of the story in both the book and as we're seeing in the show is that when you are forgotten, that is when you truly disappear from existence. As long as someone remembers you, brings you over from the old country into America, you exist as a being.
Or just even more generally through time, right? So like, right. You know, you don't have to be a god to want to be around. And Mrs. Fadil is a great example. You know, she's there and she's like, you know, her legacy is going to be carried on. But Anubis is very clear. People will mourn you for a time, then they'll find happiness again. And whatever, your grandchild will get your name. And that name, keeping that name, is one of the things that will keep her with us even after she's gone.
I hadn't even now, thought about that. But that's you're absolutely right.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So it's one of those things where, in the case of the supernaturals, they need that kind of favor and attention in order to just exist, right? But even for us, we want to pass something along, which is why it's interesting also that, you know, in the book, the Omani salesman mentions that his grandmother had mentioned the Ifrit, and Mrs. Khadil's grandmother mentioned the Ifrit. So in some way, those grandparents have existed through all this time. And it's kind of a virtuous cycle. They're passing on the tradition, so they're remembered by the children who become adults. And that remembrance is actually keeping these gods, these supernatural beings, in existence. So it's this kind of weird virtuous cycle. And it's, you know, it's always telling that way, too. One more thing about Bleef I wanted to say was Wednesday, like you said, Wednesday is like really stuck on this don't forget me thing. And he says, if at the end of this night you don't end up in jail, will you believe in me? And while on the surface, that's a thing that says, hey, will you trust me?
Yeah.
Like, will you have faith in me? He's a supernatural. So he wants him to believe in him, right? He wants that overall faith, because that's how he even said it on the airplane, right? It's faith is what's keeping the airplane aloft. He's like,
right.
Faith is what he's fueled on. So he wants Shadow to give him his faith. And that line, to me, was almost as powerful as the one that Tosin just read off about being forgotten. So, and then the last thing I want to say about belief is that, you know, Shadow's given this coin by Zoria Polochnaya, and before that, she's looking at his wrist or his hand or something to read some aspect of his fortune with her virginal powers.
Yeah.
And she says, you believe in nothing, so you have nothing. Mm. And if you think about it deep down, Shadow doesn't have anything. He doesn't have his wife. His mother is gone. His dignity is suspect, right? I mean, he gets hit with the Mad Sweeney slur about his wife, and he all he can do is break some chopsticks. So Shadow has all he's got right now is kind of Wednesday, and that's not much because Wednesday's a jerk. So that was really interesting to me. So believe in nothing, so you have nothing.
That's probably going to be his arc throughout this show, is going from believing in nothing to believing in something. Okay, so Wednesday and his storm. So we're talking about the storm outside of the Zoria sisters in Chernobog apartment. So Wednesday making this weather change and apparently taking days to do it, but he did it, making the weather change and bringing the storm the rainstorm when he walks with Zoria through the streets.
Yeah, Zoria says she can taste him on the rain, so I think that really keys us in that he's having some sort of effect on bringing the storm about.
It's one of those things I thought was interesting. We know that that's not in the book, that Wednesday doesn't control things directly like that. He's not like an X-Men, right? So that was pretty interesting. What was also interesting is, like, guys, maybe you can answer this question for me. The significance of him standing under the rain with Zoria Vectronaya, right?
Yeah.
He's like, let's go outside, let's go for a walk. I mean, there's also the question of, like, he's talking about how he likes these buxom pale chicks and he's hanging out with her when you know he gets buxom pale chicks. I didn't really understand that. But what I really didn't get was why they went outside, what that was really about, going out in the cold, having the rain begin to fall, having the umbrella. It was a beautiful visual.
Yeah.
I didn't really pick up on any kind of deeper significance.
I think that it's a, his sort of fawning over Zoria, the elder Zoria, is a deference to the inner beauty that she had at one time. Because I think he refers to that also in that scene where she's in her room brushing her hair. And he's like, you know, you should be used to greater things, you know, people fawning over you.
You were meant for extravagance.
Right, meant for extravagance. So that is sort of, he's calling back to her inner splendor.
Mm-hmm. Her former glory in some ways.
Yeah, former
glory. Yeah, and probably to another extent, you know, she gave him this prediction of, you know,
death and destruction.
Of death and destruction, and I think it kind of shows that he does have a good amount of control. It shows a little bit of his potential power here, and that he makes the future. He makes the rain. He can change up the weather and potentially can change up what will happen in the future, since that's his current prediction, not his prediction, you know, at that day of time.
Yeah, this is really interesting. It's a big distinction between faith, like faith in someone, and fate, right? And I mean, Andy, you mentioned this last week. We often see three sisters in mythology, and we think about the fates. People
right.
who, you know, whether it's Norse mythology or it's you know, Greco-Roman mythology. Mm-hmm. These three sisters that basically can tell how long someone's going to be around. And these sisters have that power too here in the show. But what's also interesting is that, you know, Wednesday cares a lot about faith. People should believe in him. And it's almost like now that you guys are talking about this, I'm thinking his charm and everything pretty much got her to believe in him again. If she was like, well, you're going to die. You know, there's nothing there, right? He's like, well, let me take you outside and show you like the real nature of my power, maybe that kind of thing. But at the end of the day, he's not concerned with fate, with what's supposed to happen to him, because he believes he has power over his fate. What he doesn't have power over is faith, and he wants to get people to believe in him. That's an interesting distinction that I guess the show is talking about without talking about. You know, rather than give us some sort of long soliloquy on it or whatever, they just kind of they go right into that. So. They force us to think about it. So that's kind of cool.
Let's go to Shadow and the snowstorm. So let me ask you guys this question. Wednesday needs a dandelion and all Shadow needs to do is look at marshmallows. Is it Wednesday's belief in Shadow that gave way to the storm, or Shadow's belief in his self?
So I'm thinking, because of what Tosin said, it's a bit of both, right? Tosin's like, it's definitely Wednesday's storm because of the dandelion thing. I think maybe Wednesday kicked off the storm, you know, it takes a lot of planning. He's like, imagine he's like Gandalf, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, Gandalf can do certain things, but they're not exactly easy things, but they're still really important things. And if he has to start a storm in order to get the money for his adventure, whatever he's trying to pull off, to use another kind of Hobbit reference, then he needs to start it early. So he starts it in Indiana, Eagle Point, and it takes its time to get over to Illinois, to Chicago, and he gets the rain, but he also needs to get it cold, and he can only take it so far, and it's almost like he requires Shadow to take it to the next level with whatever power Shadow has, which we're not sure whether he's really supernatural or he's just in the middle of all this stuff. So that was really interesting. And in the morning time, when Shadow wakes up after hanging out with Zora Poluchnaya and getting another chess game in with Chernobog, he's like, oh, Storm died. And Wednesday's like, what? He says, no, it hasn't. We're going to rob a bank. You want some coffee? So it's it's random, right? But at the same time, it's like he knows that he set it up. Now it's time for Shadow to do it, which also works with the whole bank robbery. The bank robbery is a two-man job, and it's almost like the snowstorm is a two-man job.
Interesting. I didn't connect those two, but that's certainly a possibility. Yeah. Let's talk about Mad Sweeney, the one character we haven't seen in a while. So here is a guy who is, you know, he is as a leprechaun, good luck has always been his fated to be his, at his side. And in this episode that we see that he is down on his luck, and there's a direct connection from what we saw in the last episode and in this episode, or a direct connection between what we saw in the first episode and in this episode as to the possibility of why Mad Sweeney is down on his luck. And I think he realizes it too when he, after a couple of things happen to him, and he's like, oh, of course. You know,
these are incredible things that happened to him, by the way.
Yeah.
The fact that, well, I mean, he's lucky enough not to get, I guess she wasn't aiming for his face, but he's lucky enough not to get shot. But it's a pretty shitty situation. And then obviously in the car, you know, a guy picks him up and it feels like luck. It's another like example of, that's another example of them playing with us, like with the ladder. Right.
Yeah.
He's like, he gets picked up by the car. They go, okay, he'll be fine. And then, you know, the guy gets like, killed, crazy killed, like the most freak accident. That's like, I don't know. Have you guys ever seen The Descent? It's like the same thing. It's kind of like crazy or, freak accident.
Or what was it? The Urban Legends movies.
Yes.
these would be horribly bad luck, even for normal mortals. Right. So you know, it's incredible. It's like he's now a magnet for bad luck. Now without,
yeah, that's the opposite of what is like. Instead of just having no luck, he's got all this bad luck.
Yeah, and it's because of this coin, right? This sun coin that he had that he accidentally gave to Shadow.
That's, I know.
Which in itself is a sign of bad luck, isn't it?
What? Giving away coins?
Giving or away asking... your lucky coin.
Yeah, or asking for your stuff back is also, I feel like that's bad luck. No one's going to like you if you say, hey, you can have this, but then no. I think that, you know, something interesting about Mad Sweeney? He's kind of like luck privileged, right? Like, the fact that he's completely, like, slovenly. He doesn't give a crap about anything. He's sitting there on the toilet with his pants down. Like, he doesn't... He's like, everything will be fine. Like, I can push my body to the absolute limit because everything will be fine because I have luck on my side.
Yeah,
I got a gun pointed at me. I'm not worried. And that's really interesting because when he loses that, then he's like... You can see the pit form in his stomach, right, when he realizes that he doesn't have his coin. Shriver's acting's pretty good there. And he's like, oh, shit. And then the fact that he's traveling all the way back to Indiana to get access to that thing, that's also crazy.
Yeah. We'll get into this when we talk a little bit more about the sort of the performance. But I want to come back to Pablo Shriver on this because, again, what a fantastic character and well done job on the actor himself. Let's talk about some of the supernatural characters in this episode. The Zoria sisters.
So we talked about them last week, and we didn't get a full picture because we didn't meet Zoria Polichnaya. So here are the quick things we know. We said last week that she's the Midnight Star. What she watches is confirmed. She's looking at Odin's wing and the Great Bear. It's a thing, not a god, but like a god, it's a bad thing chained up in the stars. So she's looking for the ancient Slavic demon that, if it escapes, will destroy the planet and do so quickly. We also know that she's a virgin and thus has power. And despite the fact that the other two are her sisters, one's middle-aged, one's elder, and she's a youth. And that was really interesting because I don't quite think that was clear in the book, but it's very clear in the show. And again, Green and Flora are using very powerful visual elements to tell a story outside of the text, which I thought was pretty cool. And the entire encounter is kind of a dream. But the whole thing is that she's awake through the night, which explains why she's asleep through the day. And that's, I think, pretty interesting about her. So that's what we got on her. Tosin, who's next?
So we got Anubis, a.k.a. Mr. Jekyll. So according to Wikipedia, Anubis is the name of a god associated with mummification and the afterlife in ancient Egyptian religion. Usually depicted as a canine or a man with a canine head. In this case, it was just a black man. Archaeologists identified the sacred animal of Anubis as an Egyptian canid that at the time was called the golden jackal, but recent genetic testing has caused the Egyptian animal to be reclassified as the African golden wolf. So he, only had a small role to play in this episode. Hopefully we'll see him in later episodes. But we talked a lot about him guiding the lady to pick her door, or at least he picked the door for her.
Yeah, she was. That was pretty awesome. Andy, do we have a book of the week this week?
Yeah, so let's. This is normally a feature of our other podcast, The Drill Down, but we're going to carry it over on this podcast as well. So we're going to talk about a book that is available on the Audible service, and the book is Trigger Warning: Short Fictions and Disturbances. This is another book by Neil Gaiman. And why is this book significant, other than being by the same author as American Gods, Neil Gaiman?
So this book is pretty cool because it's a anthology of short stories. He writes a whole bunch of short stories, and you know he's Gaiman, so they're kind of kooky and a little creepy and all those other things. But one of them really sticks out, and it's in our ephemera this week. It's a story called Black Dog, and we see Shadow, who's in England, and he's dealing with other supernaturals. I don't really think of Shadow as kind of like a swashbuckling superhero or anything like that, but his character is pretty interesting, the way you think about how he interacts with people. And if you kind of like want to know more, see kind of how he behaves in other situations, and kind of see him on the go, it's a great story. And the whole book is full of stuff that you're going to like. It's one of those things where you can see Gaiman, he's constantly writing, and every once in a while he just puts together these kinds of anthologies for people to pick up, and for him to, you know, kind of jot down what's on his brain when it comes to his characters or these universes. Because he's a universe guy, right? The Sandman is all about a universe, and I think American Gods is probably his literary universe as opposed to his comic universe. So
you see
it's definitely pretty good.
You see him coming back to some of the same themes over and over again, myth and faith. So it's definitely a recurring theme for him.
Yeah.
So in order to select that book from our Audible Book of the Week selection here, all you have to do is sign up at audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. We're using our code from our other podcast, The Drill Down. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it and you still get to keep that book for free. That is the Audible's deal when you use our URL, is you get to pick one book from their thousands and thousands of selections. So, and that's the one we're suggesting this week. Trigger Warning, Short Fictions and Disturbances by Neil Gaiman. All right, we're going to take a short break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some changes from the book, between the book and this particular episode. And extra stuff, some extra links that will help you help enhance your enjoyment of the show.
I went down to St. James Infirmary. Saw my baby there. She was stretched out on a long white table, so cold, so sweet, so fair. Let her go, let her go, God bless her. Wherever she may be, she can look this wide world over, but she'll never find a sweet man like me.
Bragging.
All right, so let's talk about some changes from the book to the episode that we saw tonight. Dwayne, why don't you tell us about some of these changes that we noticed?
Gotcha. So last week, we noted something like 14 changes from the book for episode 2. And it's, you know, it was true. But at the same time, a lot of those things weren't super significant. So this week, we're sticking to the three most significant things. And in future weeks, we're just going to mention the most significant changes that we have from the book and in the show. Andy, what's the first one?
Oh, so, well, right off the bat, the whole Somewhere in America story we saw at the head of the episode, the one with Mrs. Fadil and her canned peaches or whatever they were, completely an invention for the show. It did not exist in the book at all. I thought it was an interesting thing. It's interesting the sort of some of the dialogue that she has with Anubis, especially the thing about the middle name being bullshit, that totally feels to me like a Brian Fuller touch, and that's something that I don't feel like I could hear in Neil Gaiman's voice. So it's interesting that that is one of the significant differences, the additions to the book. I like the idea of these Somewhere in Americas, and this week we got two. Tosin, what else did you notice?
We have Zoria Poluchnaya, who seems younger in the show than what she was in the book. Potentially a virgin. Hard to say because she's asking for a kiss from Shadow as one of the things that she has never had before or never experienced before. So that was interesting and sort of a unique take there.
Yeah, that was pretty. Yeah, she was new characterization that felt really real. So that was cool. Then the last one we want to say is Mad Sweeney's exhumation of Laura's grave. So that's definitely not in the book, but I think it's another way that they're using the visuals to show us a kind of new storyline that's very much tied in with the old one. You know, when we see that Laura's not in the grave, now we're stuck wondering where the hell is she, and where is this coin? And we also see that the coin, you know, when in the first episode, the coin kind of falls on the ground and it kind of magically begins moving downward. But we now know that it was pulled through some sort of force to the point where it burned a hole in the coffin and she's no longer there. There's not blood. There's not like bits of her. Yeah. Didn't destroy her. So that's going to be interesting because, I mean, we're three episodes into what's probably a 10 episode season. And you know, one of the characters that is the precipitating action for the whole thing, you know, if Shadow's wife hadn't died, he wouldn't be with Mr. Wednesday going through all this stuff, is now missing. So, yeah, we were just talking about what it means to people to be able to linger on Earth, whether it's through a middle name and a grandchild or through people having faith in you. I think we're about to learn something brand new here.
All right, let's talk about some of the surface level details, some of the acting, cinematography, music, that kind of thing. First of all, I want to give props to Pablo Schreiber in the fact that it took me like literally two episodes to realize that this is the same actor from Orange is the New Black who played Pornstache. So, I mean, this is a guy with some incredible range. And to do Mad Sweeney in the way that he's done, it's just really, really good work. Like, he's really embraced this character and pretty much every other character that he plays, he just sort of like really digs into it and really gives it his all. So he disappears in the role. So props to him for sure.
Yeah, he was great. I thought it was particularly good. The makeup was fantastic with the piece of glass that was in his face that he had to pull out. Right? That was really cool. And then there was also just this kind of thing where, you know, you look at his beard and it's like this like crazy beet red. And you look at like how he does this thing where all the coins come flying out of his sleeves and pockets. And he's like, you know, he's so incensed. And again, he's just so, I can't believe I lost that damn coin. And then he has to figure out where he lost it. And it's got to be Shadow. And then he finds Shadow, which is also a thing. But yeah, that performance is pretty good. I also want to give it to Shadow, Ricky Whittle. He's beginning to reconcile this world. He's on top of that rooftop with Zoria Poluchnaya, and when she kisses him, you'd think, hey, cute girl's kissing you. He's like, I'm not so interested in you. Like, he's instead of like the normal, like, kind of stereotypical dude thing, like, yeah, I can get into that, he's like, okay. And I thought that was a really great face. He makes his pursed up, very kind of like, I'm ugh. Okay, let's just move on.
I have to say something about that, and you know, I hadn't really considered this. I mean, there was something sort of nagging at me a little bit from the beginning of this show, and I couldn't quite place my finger on it. I was listening to our colleagues over at Slash Filmcast and our buddies over there, Devendra Hardawar, who was a former co-host of The Drill Down, our other podcast, and his colleagues, David Chen and Jeff Cannata, they all watched American Gods as well. And I have to agree with, I think it was Jeff who said that that Ricky Whittle is sort of the weak link in this cast. And I think it's because in contrast to these super heavy hitters like Ian McShane, you know, and Pablo Schreiber, who's got some good chops behind him as well. You've got these heavy hitters who are really strong, charismatic actors. And Ricky Whittle, to me, so far has come off a little dry, a little flat, and I'm not sure. I'm hoping that improves. But you know, considering that he is the central character that you're hanging this show off of, I'm a little disappointed.
That's interesting. I look at Ricky Whittle and I think that what he's done is, we've mentioned it before, he's given a lot to a character that has absolutely no personality.
Mm-hmm.
When you read this book, there's no personality. If you're playing a god, right? If I'm Ian McShane, well, I'm Ian McShane, okay. But there's that. But then, you know, Ian McShane's backstory is one that goes back hundreds or a thousand years. Same with the Zoria sisters. Same with, you know, Pablo Schreiber's character. And I think that what Ricky Whittle's been given in the character is something that doesn't have a lot of anchors. And so he's got to be the one that's anchored in this idea of, like, I've got to be the straight man for all this. And that straight man is going to be somewhat dry. But there are these moments, I feel like, when he's bringing Shadow alive in a way he wasn't in the book. I mean, there are times in the book where, you know, Shadow sees something completely incredible, ridiculous, or awful.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah. You know? When Shadow's, like, presented with the whole robbing of a bank in the book, he doesn't really know what's going to happen. And then he kind of just takes it in stride. Everything's taken in stride. It's like looking across the street. He's seeing the whole thing happening with Wednesday and taking the money, and the cop rolls up. And that whole part where Ricky Whittle's like, oh shit, fuck me, whatever. Shadow he's just got out of jail. And he doesn't want to go back into jail.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there's nothing in the book that gives him that. And I think that Ricky Whittle is bringing a lot to that character.
Maybe
Is he junior compared to everybody else? Absolutely.
Maybe he's playing it a little safe here at the beginning, and maybe as his character arc moves forward and he begins to care a little bit more, as we talked about, you know, you've got nothing that you believe in, as he is given more to believe in, perhaps that performance will gain an additional depth, which is what I'm hoping. But for now, I'm just...
Yeah, I think you're right, though, because the whole thing is you believe in nothing, so you have nothing.
Right.
It's kind of hard to be... That super deep guy when, I mean, the character, unfortunately, is not deep. So I think, overall, I think that you're right. There's some really heavy hitters in this show. But I also think that he's been given the least to work with. I mean, Tosin, you want to talk about one of the heavy hitters, right?
Yeah, Ian McShane is as charismatic as ever. He really, you know, shines as one of the main primary leads in the show in this episode. And in how he portrays the character of Wednesday and the lines he says and sort of the emotions, the role was built for him, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he continues to be as great as ever. So
one other thing I wanted to talk about was the salesman and the Ifrit or the Jinn. You've got this supernatural, and we didn't really get into him in our
This is the other Somewhere in America story in this episode. We didn't really talk about it, but this is directly out of the book. It's a huge chunk of the book, and it's nice again that we see this in the episode. But you like those performances?
Yeah, I thought they seem pretty genuine. We've got you know, it's pretty much led by Masa Kreish, who plays the Jinn or the Ifrit, the Omani spirit that is residing in the U.S. as a cab driver. And I think what we see here is, you know, throughout the story so far, there's always been a love scene. It's usually involved, you know, Wednesday's got a little kind of love scene thing in the second episode.
Yeah.
And then obviously there's Belkis in the first and second episodes. And here the show's love scene, the episode's love scene is between these two men. And in a mainstream thing, you don't see a lot of that.
Right.
And what's really interesting is that you typically don't see people from Middle Eastern climes in these scenes, because in those spaces it's extremely taboo, to the point where, like, you know, execution can happen for being for having a homosexual act. So
I just wanted to say this one thing.
The way that they made that feel real,
yeah,
like two guys who just met one another but wanted to be together, that, I mean, the emotional connection between those two actors felt pretty real. And I was kind of like, how's this going to work? I remembered it from the book. And in the book, I remember thinking how they're going to translate it. And mm-hmm. I don't know. I thought they did it really well. What were you going to say?
I was just going to agree. You know, when I read the book, and this is right out of the book, I'm like, okay, how are they going to do this? Because it's pretty explicit in the book. There's no, there's nothing left to question. Much like the Bilquis scene, the first Bilquis scene that we saw. And sure enough, they didn't shy away from it. It's right in the text of the episode. So, the one part of that scene that wasn't in the book that I felt
was the celestial sex when they turn into like statues of like translucent gods.
Well, not so much that as the part where in the episode you see the djinn transferring his spirit via basically his sperm into the body of the other man, Salim. Mm. So and that wasn't very clear if mentioned at all in the book, but I like right. that it's explained in the context of the episode.
I'm not really sure what he was transferring. I know that some, you know, obviously an exchange happened, exchange, whatever, spiritual exchange.
You saw Salim's eyes become fire, like the djinn.
Right,
was.
That was kind of like they got fired up just because he was kind of making love to the supernatural creature. But in the book, the next day, Salim is effectively like, okay, I'm a cab driver now, and I'm happy. It's almost as if the djinn gave him a wish. I don't want to have my life, so he gave him a new life.
That's the way I interpreted it. Is the djinn sort of passed his power onto Salim, and now Salim has become the new djinn, and the djinn is who was the djinn is now free to be. He's been released from the bondage as the djinn.
Oh, kind of like if you're stuck in a bottle,
exactly,
a lamp. See, I get that, but he's still a djinn because we see him in episode 2 when Shadow comes back from meeting from the store where he saw I Love Lucy.
But when did that happen in the context of this? Of when?
That's true. We don't know when it happened in time. But actually, we know it happened later. And here's why we know. The djinn, when we see him in the second episode, is wearing the blue suit that he got from Salim.
Okay.
Because he leaves Salim his clothes, and he's wearing the blue suit.
So maybe
so he's transferred out of the he's transferred out of whatever stuck paradigm he was in.
Yeah.
In the cab, it's a lamp. But he's still a djinn.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we'll see an expansion of this story, because we really only get the one scene in the book, so maybe we'll see an expansion in the show.
It's also the first time we've seen a Somewhere in America becoming part of the mainline plot.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And that's pretty interesting, because we don't see that anywhere else so far, so I'm kind of excited to see how they keep on doing that.
Speaking of, what do you guys hope or expect to see in the next episode of American Gods?
Yeah, I'm hoping that we figure out what happened with Laura. Yeah. I mean, like, where's that body?
Right, because we leave it on that cliffhanger. Laura's in the room. Is she alive? Is she a zombie? What is she? And, you know, how does that interaction with her and Shadow Moon come across at that point?
Also, what's going to happen to Mad Sweeney now that he doesn't have his coin? You know, the coin burned through, maybe isn't in China. Like, you know, did it burn through the earth? So the significance of that coin is a thing. And also, you know, now we kind of know what's going to happen in Wisconsin. Everyone's supposed to meet up in Wisconsin. What's happening in Wisconsin? What's he, you know, there's some side talk around it, but there's nothing concrete yet. And I'd like to know how they lay that out, how the journey goes forward from there, even as a person who's read the book.
Yeah. All right, so let's talk about our ephemera, some extra links, external links that will help you enhance your appreciation of the show. First of all, I want to start off, Dwayne, why don't you give us something about the Egyptian underworld.
Right. So, yeah, false doors, gateways to the Egyptian underworld. A little article that lays out, you know, what your what's going on in Egypt when it comes to sort of the idea of the underworld still being present, despite the fact that Egypt is an overwhelmingly Islamic majority country. There's that. And then also the only thing I'd mention is Neil Gaiman's trigger warning, which we mentioned right above in the Audible Book of the Week. Andy?
Yeah, I want to re-recommend the link that I recommended last week, which is the American Gods Wikia wiki. Mm-hmm. Which encompasses the now not only Neil Gaiman's original source book, but also the series. And Dwayne, you've been doing some work in that, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been doing some editing because every once in a while you see something and it's like there's no reference or someone made it up or whatever. And since we've been recording the show, it's forced me to reread the book and check out some of the other tales like Black Dog, like the Anansi Boys, things like that. So I've been trying to just throw some... throw some knowledge in there and make sure that it's all copacetic because it's a resource for people to use. I also think it's interesting. Some places, like, for instance, Game of Thrones and A Song of Ice and Fire, their book and a TV show and a book, respectively, the same material. The books have their own wiki, a wiki of Ice and Fire. And
right.
The show has its own wiki, the Game of Thrones wiki. And never the two shall meet. Meanwhile, The Walking Dead has a single Wikia page. But in that Wikia page, they actually have, for every character, they have a discussion of how she or he works in the book versus how she or he works in the show.
Interesting.
Because the show is very, it departs greatly after the second season. So it's going to be interesting to see how this wiki figures it out. Because American Gods is going to be on for at least two, if not three seasons, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be a lot of material. And we'll see what happens. With how they organize it, but you know, obviously there are a couple ways to go, the Walking Dead way or the Song of Ice and Fire Game of Thrones way.
Yeah. So Tosin, how about yourself?
Well, this one's for the kids, but it's a website, Ancient Egypt for Kids. So I know when I was a youngin, we didn't really cover much of Egypt in grade school, and this great website teaches a lot of kids and probably adults too, if you don't know this information, about like the afterlife, you know, dressing up your mummy, grave robbers, all sorts of other interesting things about Egyptian history, as well as quizzes and games and things of that nature. So we'll have that in our show notes for you guys to check out.
And that is going to do it for this episode of The Dominant Paradigm, covering episode 103 of, or covering, that is going to do it for this episode of The Dominant Paradigm, covering episode 3 of American Gods, Head Full of Snow. And we will see you guys on the next episode of The Dominant Paradigm, covering episode 4 called Get Gone. So I'm excited to see what that's about. And where can we find you guys when you're not here on The Dominant Paradigm? Dwayne, how about yourself?
Check me out on twitter.com/DwayneD, D-W-A-Y-N-E-D. Also check me out on DwayneD.com. And I'm on Geeks of Doom. Tosin, where can we find you?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, other ramblings at toastr2d2.tumblr.com, and then you can also find me also on geeksofdoom.com. What about yourself, Andy?
You can find me at mrbabyman.com. That is Mr. Babyman's my social media handle, so you can find everything that I'm liking and linking throughout the week there. Also, if you just do a Google search for Andrew Cercini or Mr. Babyman, you'll find all of my social links there. Again, don't forget those ways to contact us: Gods Podcast on Twitter, Podcast American Gods on Facebook. And until then, we'll see you next week on The Dominant Paradigm for episode 4, Get Gone. See you guys later.